Freedom News Hour with Jake Towns, Walt Thiessen, and Gene DiNardo, Thursdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Progressive Radio Network.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds.
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, and I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-hosts Jake Town and Gene DiNardo on this Thursday, October 20th, 2011, and some of the headlines we're seeing today and this week include the fact that over in Greece, the riots have turned violent as protesters no longer are satisfied with peaceful protestation. Now some so-called anarchists are getting involved in actual violence against the police. Here in the United States, the August trade report numbers are in, and they're not particularly great. Neither are the inflation numbers, which are up. No surprise there, but it's nice to know that the government is recognizing that they exist at all. But the big news of the day is the death of dictator Muammar Gaddafi, and Jake Town has the details on that. Jake?
Sure. Muammar Gaddafi, the strongman and dictator of Libya for about 40 years or so, was in pretty graphic imagery, was at first located apparently on camera alive and wounded, and was later seen dragged through the streets of his hometown and rebel hometown behind a truck. So the fall of Gaddafi marks possibly the end of the Libyan civil war. Certainly it kind of marks the end of the Gaddafi administration in more ways than one. But for those that might not be too familiar with the government and politics of Libya, the country is, as many countries in the region, is separated in a manner of tribes. So it's unclear whether the violence will in fact end or whether it will continue. You have to say NATO got what it wanted with all the bombings and everything. It got Gaddafi dead.
Yes, they certainly did, and you're right, it does remain to be seen how the whole thing will shake out, because he didn't leave very much of a government infrastructure behind, so it's not like the rebels can just take over and pick up where he left off. They're basically going to have to recreate from scratch, and given the current state of the of what is left of politics in Libya, that is going to prove to be a major challenge. The other message that I kind of take away from all this is, isn't it interesting how once again a brutal dictator, when finally loses his grip on power, his death is quite bloody, and the response from around the world to his death has been quite predictably, thank goodness the rat got what he deserved. The one thought that kind of goes along with that, though, is what about the other dictators? I wonder how they're reacting today. How do the leaders of China feel about this? How does Fidel Castro feel about this? How about the strongman down in Venezuela? I mean, how do all these people feel? Because basically what they saw with this is the same thing they saw with, say, Saddam Hussein or some of the other strongmen who have basically met very nasty demises, and they certainly have to have nightmares about the possibility this could happen to them, because this is ultimately what happens with any strongman, with any tyrant, that he always has to end up fearing his own people.
Yeah, I think the closer they are to the action there, the more they might be shaken a little bit. I think Fidel, or I guess his brother's running it, being distant, and so it's such a distance and kind of a different situation, might not feel as bad as some of the neighboring countries. But I was kind of curious, Jake, they dragged him through his hometown behind a truck, and there wasn't any resistance from his supporters? Nobody was shooting at him?
No, I believe he was actually dragged through the streets in a rebel town. I think it was Misrata.
Oh, okay.
The fairly graphic video and stuff that I've watched from Al Jazeera, it's still not quite apparent, but he was found next to a tunnel. And apparently he was acquired alive but wounded. It's unclear exactly how he died, from the point where he was, at least conscious to the point where he was dead being dragged. So it's kind of, the same thing with Saddam Hussein, though. Just because Saddam Hussein died, it doesn't necessarily mean that the violence is going to end. It does mean that the dictatorial regime is passing, which is good, except we covered this before on the show, we're not quite sure who we're replacing Gaddafi with. It could just be another tribe, in which case you're just simply kind of passing on from one evil to the next. And Obama, he called this, President Obama of the United States, and they call this a, you know, more or less a good thing. But you don't have to really go all that far back in the Obama presidency to see Obama shaking hands and kind of laughing with Gaddafi. So I would kind of echo the thoughts of Walt here. You know, what is Hugo Chavez thinking, and all these other dictators that have just watched the rebel insurgency being supported by Western military powers and NATO.
Yeah, right.
And removing dictators from power—it's certainly going to call into question, the existence of the other dictatorship regimes. And again, the United States has friendly dictatorships. We were friendly with Egypt for a very, very long time. We sponsored their military. We're very friendly with the Saudi Arabian dictator. Or king, however you want to call it, but there's all this evidence that they aren't very nice to their people. Same thing with Bahrain and a lot of the other oil countries. So we'll see what the future brings.
It was particularly interesting to see some of the responses from people who were victims of his regime. Noteworthy were some of the Lockerbie bombing victims' families who expressed great relief that he was gone. In fact, one of the victims' mothers said she was going to buy the most expensive bottle of champagne she could find in order to celebrate. There's also the five Bulgarian nurses who were imprisoned in Libya for 8 years over an HIV scandal. They welcomed the news in a variety of different ways. One of them had a very graphic thing to say. Her name is Valya Shervinyaska. I probably mispronounced that. She said, "The news made me very happy. It's a punishment. A dog like him deserved to die like a dog." Personally, I think that dogs everywhere should be insulted by that, but nevertheless, I understand the sentiment. On the other side of the scale was another one of those nurses who said, "I can't be happy about anyone's death, even my enemy." Interesting response from somebody who was basically victimized by a strongman. So we have been getting reactions from across the board.
The other thing that's interesting, you mentioned, the possible power vacuum. It was my understanding that it was not one group. The rebels are made up of many groups and just people who oppose Gaddafi, so there could be a power struggle there, too, and more problems for the country.
Yep, absolutely true. Well, while we celebrate and or cry over the demise of the late and unlamented in most ways Muammar Gaddafi, there are other things happening in the world, particularly over in Europe. And Jake, we're going to go to you once more, because not only are they rioting in Greece, but there is a whole lot of shakedown going on in the rest of the European Union. What's going on over there?
Right. Well, Greece passed a new so-called austerity bill, and they were greeted by major riots. The parliament was pretty much evenly divided. The 300-member parliament voted 154 to 144. They are still receiving money from the European bailout system, and that's really what's kind of driving a lot of these news. There's been talk of taking the current bailout fund and combining it and increasing it quite a bit. There's kind of like rumors all over the place from either doubling it or moving it up to 2 trillion euros to 1 trillion to 1.3 trillion euros. Things are not set down in stone, but the current 440 billion euro, the European Financial Stability Facility, or the EFSF, has spent or committed already 160 billion euros. And again, this is pretty much just printed money. Theoretically, it's coming from the sponsoring governors. But the loans to Greece will run up to 30 years. This temporary facility is slated to be replaced by the European Stability Mechanism, sounds kind of funny, which will hold 500 billion euros in mid-2013, so still 2 years away. However, the ongoing bond crises or government bond crises, even Germany had an auction that wasn't quite failed, but it wasn't filled up with, did not get enough bids to cover the entire auction of 10-year bonds earlier this week. So what kind of seems to be happening is that the EU is kind of struggling to find another mechanism besides its central bank in order to bail out or money print and cover up these failing economies. So that's kind of like my personal read on it. German Chancellor Angela Merkel, she canceled a planned speech to Parliament in Berlin on this whole very sensitive bailout EFSF speech because there's a deadlock in how they're going to leverage it, whether they're going to double it or what have you. The budget spokesman for Merkel's Free Democratic Party stated that the French want more money from Germany than we are prepared to shoulder. So, and you know, the question is, you know, where is the money coming from? Because it's not as if Germany has no debt; they have plenty of debt as well. So it's going to be interesting to see how it goes. But kind of what I see happening is we kind of have almost like a secondary central bank forming up.
A secondary central bank.
Well, in the means of, you know, here in the United States, we had Congress vote in 2008 and had this TARP plan, which was sort of one time and a facility that was run directly by the government, but it was backed up fully by the Federal Reserve. This is maybe a second central bank isn't the right word for it, but it's kind of like a subsidiary of the European Central Bank, and is what it could become in the future. Right now, the countries are trying to demonstrate control over it, but the future is very, very uncertain. Stock markets are reacting sharply up and down this entire week as different rumors keep coming out. So it's hard to see exactly what's going to come out. What is very clear is that the governments want to have some way to paper over other economies crashing, whether it's going to be Portugal or Italy or Spain into the future. And certain members, such as Germany, are starting to get a little bit uncomfortable with how this is all unfolding for them.
And rightfully so, because this is a mess that is only starting to unfold. And I don't get the feeling that the politicians over there have really gotten their heads around the fact that this is a huge crisis. They still haven't been able to face up to that. They're showing signs of it. The fact that Greece is passing austerity budgets and the Germans and the French are showing signs of taking it seriously shows that they have some idea of it. But I really wonder how much they truly appreciate just how badly damaged this whole fiat monetary system truly is.
Now, do you think they are just fearful of printing too many euros, or they're just fearful of actually losing the money, you know, as far as the German outlook goes?
Well, you know, in Greece, they're kind of getting a little bit uncomfortable losing control over their people. And, you know, the whole Occupy Wall Street movement, which we'll be talking about later on the show with our guests, that's kind of spreading. And what you kind of see is, you know, the officials of the EU are pretty much unelected, and they have a decent amount of power. And that's they're trying to. So you have a power struggle among the European elite, which want to see a united Europe into the future for the good of every European, and also for the good of their pockets. Is the truth of the matter. And it's hard to say exactly what's going on, but what people are learning is this socialism doesn't quite work because you just have other people that aren't, kind of pulling their quote-unquote fair share being bailed out by others. So it's all kind of just a huge paper mess. And, again, when you take a look at the history of all these paper currencies, they don't last forever. So I think this crisis is certainly not over. I don't even think we've gotten to the meltdown phase, which is probably going to come later. It could actually take years with all the things that they're trying to do in terms of delaying. But, again, it could also just be set off like something like Credit Anstalt, the Austrian bank, when it went down during the Great Depression, that just kind of or sort of like a Lehman shock in modern terms that kind of sets off panics in the stock markets and the government bond markets, which is where you're seeing a lot of stress. And really just with the people. So I think that's where a lot of the fears are of, the riots spreading and whatnot.
I agree. It could definitely be another layman event, but I don't really see it being something that delays itself for years and years, because the signs are there for anyone who cares to read them that the whole system is in turmoil, not just in Europe, but the entire world monetary system is in turmoil right now, massive turmoil. I mean, I saw it was a YouTube video of a BBC News, not a broadcast, but like a little snippet of the broadcast. They had a guy on who was an independent trader, and his whole gig, so to speak, was basically to say that the system's screwed, and traders who are in the know are doing everything they can to bet against it and to basically short the market in whatever safe ways they can think of, because nobody really expects Europe to recover from this, and ultimately nobody really expects the whole debt-based monetary system to recover. But you don't hear that being reported on the major news networks. You don't hear it being reported in any of the major circles. You don't see it on the network news. You don't see it in the newspapers. And yet, if you look around, I mean, the signs are all there. So, I mean, I just don't see how it's going to not be a major event. It's just a question of when the event comes.
Of course, if these guys are shorting the system at some point, who's going to pay them?
Yeah, well, what they're counting on is for the whole thing to fall apart, so that they end up keeping the money that they bought into when they shorted their stocks and so forth in the first place.
Right.
But anyway, we do have a guest, as Jake mentioned, Lise Wheel from Fox News. She's a legal analyst who has appeared numerous times on the Bill O'Reilly Show, and she's going to be joining us to talk about some of the legal issues involved in Occupy Wall Street, so you're going to want to stay tuned for that. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. Yeah, run back to your dial, because we're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, and Lise Wheel, a Fox News commentator on the Fox O'Reilly Factor, the segment's called Is It Legal? She's joining us here today, and Lise is a very skilled and prominent trial attorney. She's a professor of law at New York Law School, quite a bit of credentials to her credit. A novelist and a nonfiction book writer. So, Lise Wheel, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's so great to be with you. I'm sorry there's so much noise back here. I've got to go air in a few minutes, but you're exactly right. Is It Legal? Every Tuesday night on Bill O'Reilly, and then check us out on IMIF on Blonde on Blonde on Wednesday.
All right, very good. Well, we had you on the program because of your legal expertise. We were kind of fishing out beforehand, trying to figure out which issue to focus on. It seemed at this point, because of what's happening on Occupy Wall Street, that's probably the best one to focus on with your background. So can you tell us, from your perspective, what are some of the issues you've been seeing that, first of all, are impacting, say, the city of New York and the other cities, but also might actually Occupy Wall Street movement itself?
Huge impact, because you've got 750 people or more that have been arrested, but they're arrested, don't forget, on low-level civil disobedience charges, just disrupting the public, disorderly conduct, that kind of thing. It's not even a misdemeanor. So what's happened is that they've got a couple of lawyers, who are saying, wait a second, we're going to... Sorry?
Oh, go ahead.
No, what they're saying is, we're going to get a lawyer. We're going to try to disrupt the whole New York system, the whole judicial system, and we're going to, if you don't let us go, we're going to make sure you let us go by dismissing the charges, and we'll clog up the whole system, which I think is ridiculous. I mean, New York handles 90,000 misdemeanors cases a year, so another 150 won't give that much of a burst.
So I take it that you don't really see a parallel between this and, say, the Boston Tea Party, which was also an act of civil disobedience and involved basically violating the law.
Well, this is different in the sense that they have been arrested. They do have to face these warrants. But what I don't like about this is that a defense lawyer is coming in and saying, kind of a threatening sort of way, that we're going to try to disrupt your whole system, you being the New York judicial system, and we'll clog you up, you'll never get through what all the other things you have to get through. I don't think that's right. I don't think that's what civil disobedience is about. Look at Mahatma Gandhi. I mean, that was past resistance. You went out there, you did what you had to do, and you were arrested if you had to be arrested, but you didn't threaten the law enforcement officials at that time.
Understandably so. And forgive us if we were reacting slowly here at times because it's a little bit hard to hear you over the background noise, so we'll just kind of work through it.
I'm so sorry. I'm at Fox. It's a little crazy right here.
I can well imagine, especially if you're getting ready for the next broadcast. But I hear your point. I guess the other question that occurs to me is the Occupy Wall Street is basically designed to be a general expression of anger at both Wall Street, the government, and all the major players that are involved. So it sounds to me what you're saying is it's inappropriate to express that kind of anger and tie it into the legal system, and yet that the legal system is what's basically trying to pull them off the street. So I guess the question that comes to my mind is, if that's not the appropriate way to express the anger, what is?
Well, they're right in the sense that men and women in this country have died for the First Amendment. We have the right to protest. We have the right to say we're mad as hell, we're not going to take it anymore. I understand that completely. But what I don't like about this is the idea of using a tactic of clogging up our court system to get their point across. That I don't like, and that to me is not right.
So what is the appropriate way to say it?
Well, I think that what they need to do is come up with, what's your agenda? I mean, okay, we're mad, I got that. We're angry, I got that. Now, give me your talking points. Give me what you want to do. How do you want to change things? How are you going to change things, and what do you want? Give me your demand points. That's what I'd like.
And if you ask the protesters that, you're going to get an answer that says we don't have a particular agenda because essentially we come from a wide variety of viewpoints, which is rather unique when you consider it, because most often, like you say, groups come together, they're kind of centered around a single viewpoint. In this case, they're saying, well, look, we're not going to try to push one agenda. We got a whole bunch of people with a bunch of different viewpoints there. Why can't we just say, hey, we want to see some change?
Well, I think you can say we just want to see some change, but then you've got to say what that change would be. You can't just say, well, I mean, of course you can, but to be effective, you can't just say, I'm angry. You've got to say, okay, I want change, and I want these things, one through five or one through ten resolved. And therefore, when I get those one through five or one through ten resolved, I've won. And then you can go back and get more people on board with your message. But if you just come out and say, I'm angry, but have no message to send, then where are you going with that?
Well, and to be perfectly fair, they have been trying to put their issues together. I mean, they have a website, I don't remember what the address is off the top of my head, where they've been actually doing a polling of their own people saying, which issues do you want to push? And we talked about it in last week's show. Some of them have come to mind that a large number of them wanted to repeal the Patriot Act. A lot of them were very, very upset about corporate personhood. They wanted to end that, particularly the case, I can't remember what the case was off the top of my head, but the case that was going through the court system about a year ago. There were a few other people like that. So there actually are some talking points that they've been emphasizing.
Well, I agree. I mean, there's a lot of anger around the Patriotism Act, a lot of anger about how that was renewed, and now with Attorney General Holder and all the issues he's embroiled in with Fast and Furious and Solyndra, I get it. But still, my point, and just come back to it, is have a message beyond anger. What is your message?
They do. That's the point. Their message is they want to end the Patriot Act. They want to stop corporate personhood. They want to stop these other things. They've been identifying and itemizing them.
That sounds like a message to me.
Well, but how do you solidify that message? How do you just put it down and say, this is what I want, this is how I'm going to change it, and I want these points made? Because then what could happen is if legislators, politicals around the country would say, okay, we get that, we'll sign off on this or that, or, one through four, or two through eight, then they could claim a victory.
Well, you're assuming, the problem is they don't get anything. I mean, you're assuming that they actually would do something people would want. I mean, that's what the whole movement's about, I think.
I'm sorry, I'm assuming what?
Well,
we're having trouble hearing
that,
you.
You know, that the thing is, the reason they're out there is because they're starting to believe that politicians don't do what people want, and that's the problem. So, you're saying they should try to get the politicians to do this and do that. Well, maybe they don't think the politicians will do anything they want.
But they want it. But how do you get change made? You've got to at least identify what the changes are that you want made, is what I'm saying. At least identify what you want to change, and then we can go from there.
Well, I think they have been identifying them. You want them to organize around those changes and create basically pressure groups to pressure the legislatures. And speaking of, as one who has come somewhat from a similar point of view, I mean, the three of us are Ron Paul supporters, and we've been supportive of the Ron Paul revolution and all that kind of thing. So there's a gentleman who very definitely has an agenda. He very definitely has talking points. Very definitely has talking points that actually cut across political boundaries. And yet, despite the fact that we've been making very definite talking points, presenting very definite ideas, I mean, it basically falls on deaf ears. So it's one thing to say that people should be expressing themselves more clearly and basically assigning what the agenda is going to be, you know, how you're going to measure when you've achieved victory. But it's another thing entirely to say that it's actually going to result in anything.
Yeah, but if you don't have an agenda, look, I'm a novelist. If I elevate myself that high, fiction. I love to write fiction, and I write books, and I write about things, and I think about when I start the book, I think about my characters, and I think about where the ending is gonna go, and what those characters will do, and what they want, and how we'll end up, and where we're gonna go from the next, you know, for the next book. So. Don't you think you want to have your political activists thinking that as well?
But our point is that we are thinking along those lines. The difficulty is that the results are not necessarily going to be there. And the reason they're not going to be there is because, really, when you think about it, the system is not designed to change. The system is designed to promote the status quo, which has been what's been going on all along. So really what the Occupy Wall Street people are saying, and I don't agree with everything that they're saying, but the one valid thing that I think they're saying overwhelmingly is we're just going to keep making noise because even when we make proposals, they don't get enacted anyway. So let's just keep making noise and just keep getting people angrier and angrier until finally the politicians say, hey, maybe we better actually do something.
I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think you just rant and rave and get your way in life. I mean, if a child has a temper tantrum, you're going to give it into the child? I don't think so. I wouldn't do it with my kids.
Well, it may not work, but I have to admit, at least I can understand where they're coming from on it. I can't say that it's inappropriate considering that the alternative has not particularly worked very well.
Yeah, but think about, again, my analogy to your kids. If your kids are jumping up and down and having a temper tantrum, you're going to give in?
So are we all just kids of the system? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I can agree with the idea that victims of the financial crisis are kids. I can't buy into the idea that victims of the financial crisis are kids, and that's basically who they're voicing. They're voicing the feelings of the victims of the financial crisis.
That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that they should have a message. A message.
Well, sure, that's what you're saying. You basically were saying that if they act like kids, that they shouldn't be listened to. But in this case, the people who you're calling kids are angry because of a very good reason.
You
it's not like
totally
acting like kids.
Sorry, you are misconstruing my words. That's not what I said.
Well, then go ahead and clarify.
What I said was we should listen to them, we should hear what their protests are, we should listen if they have an agenda. That would be great.
Okay, and then after we're done listening, then what?
And then what? Because I don't know what the and then what is. I haven't heard the message.
Well,
when I get the message,
they've obviously been against corporate personhood since day one. I mean, that's been the principle out. So what do you think about that?
I'm so sorry. I just missed the last part of your sentence. I'm so sorry. I apologize.
Oh, I know. There's just a ton of background. But what I was saying is one of their things that has run through from the first moment or the first day has basically been that they're against corporate personhood. I mean, well, what do you think about that? I mean, it's basically they're against something that probably won't change. So that's the problem.
I still didn't get it, I'm sorry, but that they're trying for a protest, I got that. I mean, but there's got to be... Hello?
Hello?
Yep, I'm here.
Unfortunately, I think we have too much noise going on. We're having trouble maintaining all the connections here.
I'm sorry, you want to try to do this tomorrow instead?
Unfortunately, this is a weekly show, so that's not going to work too much.
Okay.
Well, why don't we, since the connection's so bad, we'll probably have to just kind of cut it short here, but we do want to give you a moment to push your book. What's the latest book that you have coming out?
Waking Hours. Waking Hours just came out. It's set in an idyllic town in New York City, a little bit north of New York, East Salem, and I've got two great characters, a forensic psychiatrist meets up with a former NFL player, and they've got to solve a murder mystery, and doing that, they find some supernatural angel versus demons, good versus evil. It's a really, really good read with a lot of romantic comedy and fun stuff in there as well. I think you'll enjoy it.
Sounds like you've crossed a lot of genres there. Well, good luck with the book, and thank you for joining us on the show. Liz Wheel, Fox News analyst. Once again, thanks for joining us on the Freedom News Hour.
You got it. Take care.
And we will be back after these messages, and we'll be going on to some of the other headlines of the day, so you want to stay tuned. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network. We'll be right back. Yeah, we're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. And, Gene, unfortunately, you seem to have gotten the worst of it in terms of the connections there, because even I was having trouble hearing what you were saying.
Oh, that was terrible. I mean, I couldn't hear anything. And I tried to call, you know, five or six different times. And from what I could hear, anyway, you know, it's too bad, because it seems like there could have been actually a fairly good interview there and maybe some consensus at some point.
I have to admit, I'm a little surprised that a professional broadcaster chose to do an on-air interview from a room with that kind of background noise, but unfortunately that's the way it worked out. So,
yeah,
you know, you do what you have to do. What was the point you were trying to make about the last comment that you made about the Occupy Wall Street? You were saying something, and I just couldn't hear any of it.
Well, my point, I tried to make it a couple times, but I don't think it actually got through any time, was that she wanted them to, you know, you kept saying, and you were right, you kept saying, you know, they do have some demands. She kept saying they have to come up with an agenda. My point was, well, the stuff they want, they're not going to get. And I think they're starting, you know, I think the left liberal element, like the early Tea Party movement, is starting to realize that this stuff isn't attainable, you know, under the current system, and I think that's the point. So I was kind of going to ask her, well, what about corporate personhood? You know, they're not going to get that, and I think they know it. What do you think about that? But we never got that far.
Absolutely true. And, of course, Occupy Wall Street goes well beyond Wall Street. It's been happening in towns all across the U.S., and, in fact, there have been sympathy demonstrations and occupations going on around the world. Jake, it's even happening in your hometown, isn't it?
Right, and you know, I think the main thing, and Lise did hit on this, I think, pretty effectively, is that it is kind of like leaderless, and that way it's a little bit just like the Tea Party movement when it got going. The exception was the Tea Party groups kind of just met and held rallies everywhere. The Occupy Wall Street people are, you know, living in the middle of these cities and stuff, so it's... Just kind of different strategies, but they are complaining about slightly different things from slightly different perspectives. And again, you have to keep in contact that, you know, there is no list of demands because there is no leader. But, you know, what they are protesting is, you know, they see, you know, all these people that have a lot, and they see, okay, you know, we ourselves have very little. Yes, there's some people out there complaining about corporate greed, which probably the three of us would argue it's a little bit more about the government favoritism to corporations, or corporatism is really the main thing than corporate greed. And there's also, you know, the concern about the power and the influences of these organizations and corporations in politics. And the local Occupy Allentown, which is in my area where I grew up, and it's the third largest city in Pennsylvania after Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, so it's not exactly a small city. Their website says, you know, in a show of support, we have occupied Allentown, PA, to draw attention to corporate greed, too big to fail bailouts, and corporation of both political parties by big business. There is no difference between the Republican and Democratic parties. Both have sold us out.
Well, they got that one right.
Join us. Yeah, so, yeah, but, you know, take a look at some of the similarities. You know, the too big to fail bailouts, that was pretty much one of the chief complaints, the whole TARP thing, that kind of created the genesis of the Tea Party movement really getting going. A lot of these folks are independent, and from the conversations with a lot of these folks who try to give to their best efforts, to hear the voice of every protester, like the one in Allentown, the one thing that they ended up all agreeing on is that corporations shouldn't be controlling politics, which is kind of a no-brainer. But yet, you know, that's how things are. So it's it's a movement that, yes, it doesn't have a list of demands, but the fact that it's ongoing and that there's so many people that are, you know, looking out to do these things is quite good. It means that people are, you know, highly concerned of where things are going. There are some things that need to be, you know, kind of discussed further. You know, there's, and you know, there's people in the movement that are, you know, asking for forgiveness of all student loans and kind of a loan jubilee, and just some things that would be very, very hard to accomplish. Plus, it's very hard to define corporate greed, because the corporations of the world and the companies and the small businesses, they provide the goods and services that the rest of us use, and they employ everyone. So it's a little bit hard to see exactly how corporate greed can be a bad thing. Obviously, where you have favoritism from the government is really where most of the problems kind of develop. So I think that the intent of the protesters is, in fact, a very noble one. And again, there's actually people in the Allentown protest too that are, you know, calling about sound money. One of the leaders in the local movement is also a leader in the local anti-war group, and I think those are some of the things that a lot of these protesters that are out there, they can probably agree on at this point. They can probably agree on bailouts. They can probably agree on the wars, and those are, I would say, two of the most important things to work on with many other people from all over the political spectrum.
You know, it's interesting because I read an article by, I believe it was Chris Hedges, on Truth Out or Truth Dig, and it was kind of a liberal perspective, and I think the title was The Occupy Movement Won't Die or something like that, but he kept referring to the corporate state a number of times, and it was like what you mentioned about, you know, they're looking at the corporations and saying corporate greed, yet he was kind of getting to a more radical viewpoint where he's saying the corporate state, but then he would go back. So the article never really centered on what we're always centered on. I mean, if you're going to say corporate greed, I mean, corporations, for the most part, with a few exceptions, don't have the guns. You know, the state has the guns. The state makes the laws. So, you know, it's the state that's allowing these problems that they're seeing. But I don't think they quite, you know, like you say, there's so many different facets to the movement, but I don't think, you know, as a whole, they grasp that yet. You know, it's kind of like,
right,
go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to add, you know, if you monitor like OccupyWallStreet.org, which is the main website of the folks camping out in New York, it's I don't really think it's that uncalled to just say that it's a revolutionary socialist website. But, you know, they're also kind of going after different topics that are away from the bailouts and what have you. For instance, today they're marching against hydrofracking, so they're marching to a location and protesting that. And you know, that's a completely, actually a very valid topic to kind of discuss. But they're kind of going after these kind of smaller little things instead of like sticking to the big stuff. Like I think Wall Street's actually they're a little bit off in the targeting. If they're in front of the Federal Reserve Bank in New York, that should be their main target, in my opinion, because that's where a lot of these problems and corporatism and, in fact, all this inflation and the drop of living standards is really coming from. They're to focus on, and then also the adventurism and the militarism that we have abroad, whether we're sponsoring wars in North Africa or wars in Afghanistan and occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan. These are all things that I think you'd probably very likely find a high degree of agreement between, you know, protesters, no matter which state that they're in. And the fact that they're out there and willing to camp out and try and slow down the beast, so to speak, is it's admirable, even if perhaps the education, the specifics on the issues might not quite be there yet.
And as you mentioned, Walt, I don't think it's too far off base comparing it to the Boston Tea Party, really.
No, it's not very far off base at all, because that was truly an act of deliberate violation of the law, and it's a major part of our history. So I'm not saying that it's always a good idea to engage in civil disobedience, but certainly rejecting civil disobedience when clearly that's what it is, because you don't like the method, you know, you're kind of spitting in the face of American history when you do that. The other thought that occurs to me, Jake, you were bringing up earlier the whole question of corporate greed. I personally think it's a mistake that they're engaging in when they try to focus on that. And the reason I think it's a mistake is greed is really just a word that we use to negatively denote self-interest. And the fact is we're all self-interested. So essentially when you complain about corporate greed, what you're basically saying is corporate self-interest should be played down so that everybody else's self-interest should be played up. And that's where the whole greed thing starts to look kind of messy because, well, you know, why shouldn't we say, you know, individual greed or, you know, personal greed or politicians' greed or anyone else's greed? Why is it only corporate greed?
Well, that's also the connection. And this is where, you know, I don't think they quite get it because, okay, Walt, you can be greedy, but what's going to become of it? You know, if you make a connection to corporate greed, well, the only reason they get anywhere is because they're politically connected. You know, if you express corporate greed and you're politically connected, that equates to power and wealth and money. If you're not, it doesn't mean anything. You know, it's just kind of a character trait. You know.
And that's why the real important question is, where does corporate personhood come from? And, of course, it comes from the state, because without the state, there would be no such thing as corporate personhood. In fact, the whole idea of the corporation grew out of contracts that J.P. Morgan had with the government.
Yeah,
I mean, when you read the history, you shake your head, you say, "Oh my goodness." Well, I think we've covered that pretty well, and there are other things that we want to be talking about today, including some very disturbing trade report numbers that came out for August. And Gene, I believe you have the details on that.
Yeah, the August reports are out, and the U.S. trade deficit was essentially unchanged in August at 45.
Oh, that's not too bad then.
Well, it's funny because it was unchanged in August at 45.6 billion, but it's interesting because the commentators on this, they wanted it to actually change, and they wanted the deficit to grow worse, because that would show the consumers were spending more money.
Oh, dear.
Isn't that crazy? It says it's lowest level since April and 100 million narrow than a year earlier. Exports and imports both slipped by 100 million to 177.6 billion and 223.2 billion respectively. So the Chinese, as it goes on to say, the report from China also showed that its booming pace of export growth had begun to ease as the global upheaval and the gradual rise in the value of the yuan took their toll. The U.S. trade deficit with China grew to $29 billion, its largest level ever. The report comes at a time when U.S. officials had focused on the role of China's government in the global economy. On Tuesday, the Senate passed a bill that would impose tariffs on certain Chinese goods if the Treasury Department determined that China was undervaluing its currency to its advantage. This is interesting, and maybe it's my misunderstanding here, though, but you know, you always hear these complaints about China. But basically, and correct me if I'm wrong, they're saying that China is making its goods cheaper, right? Isn't that the whole idea between messing with their currency?
That's the general argument, yeah.
And how could that ever be bad? I don't understand. I mean, I think people forget that, you know, they say, oh, it's China this, China that. It's just what the Fed does that counterbalances and makes, you know, our situation even worse. I mean, products becoming cheaper coming into our country can never be a bad thing. I mean, why should we pay more for the same thing? It's goofy.
Well,
but, you know,
the reason they complain about it is because labor in America is much more expensive, which is a direct fallout from the fact that we are the reserve currency of the world.
Right.
And that, so as the whole debt-based monetary system just continues to grow and grow and grow, and all the so-called prosperity that goes along with it continues to grow and grow, people's salaries and wages try to keep up. They don't actually keep up, but they try to. So the whole idea that they should actually have to lose out to somebody who's making less money than them is appalling. They just can't stand that idea. They don't realize that their woes are called by the monetary system, that they're caused by the monetary system, but that's what they're reacting to.
And our own value system. I mean, if we had, no matter what China did, if we had a good value system, which was, you know, freely determined and things were valued as we valued them rather than how the Fed decided to print money,
you know, something coming into our country cheaper would only be good. I mean, it could never be bad. I mean, you're paying less for the same item. How could it be? The only reason it's bad is because we keep devaluing our own currency. And as you mentioned, we're the dominant currency. So
yeah, as long as that remains true, and as long as the dominant currency, like all fiat currencies, is based on expansion through expansion of debt, you're just going to have an ongoing bad situation that's going to get worse and worse and worse. Meanwhile, of course, it's not as if the level trade deficit is the only reason why there is cause for concern, because here in this country, the reason why people haven't been buying the Chinese goods is everything's getting so much more expensive. In fact, the Labor Department confirmed that on Wednesday when they announced the latest round of official inflation numbers, as usual, marked down from what has really gone on, because, of course, they spray out over a bunch of stuff that nobody ever buys anyway and say that's the same thing as buying fruits, vegetables, and rent. But nevertheless, the numbers were out. They are up. They are causing some disconcern among people on Wall Street. Some of the numbers that really jumped out at me: dairy prices have jumped 10.2% in the past year. Gas prices, 33.3% increase in the past year. And these are among reasons why the inflation rate has jumped 3.9%. Now, think about that. The inflation rate's gone up 3.9%, and yet in food and gasoline is skyrocketing. It shows just how screwed up the whole inflation measurement system is over at the Bureau of Labor Statistics. But nevertheless, at least they're recognizing that it's happening to some small degree. I mean, Jake, is that a little bit of a step forward? I don't know.
It could be. I'm actually paying attention. There's some breaking news in on Gaddafi's death.
Oh, what do you have?
Yeah, it's just in from Reuters. I've been reading through it, and it seems to be the reporting that he was initially taken alive by the rebels. They are also reporting that he was found in a drainage pipe full of rubbish. But it seems that this morning, or as morning broke in Libya, Gaddafi, with a few dozen bodyguards and allies, tried to break out from the siege and get out of the city and make a break to the west. France said its aircraft struck military vehicles at around 8:30 a.m. And was unsure whether it had hit Gaddafi's convoy. But and a NATO official said the convoy was either hit by a French plane or a U.S. Predator drone. Roughly 50 people were found killed next to it. And it's from some of the rebels that are reporting in, they say that the survivors of the strike, which appear to be Gaddafi and a handful of people, ran away and took refuge in a couple of drainage pipes in very open terrain. They were then captured by the rebels, placed, and Gaddafi was placed into a vehicle. It's reported that he was already wounded with gunshots to his leg and back, but was alive. At some point, he was then dragged out of the vehicle, and then it becomes very unclear what happens. There's rumors that he was killed after being tortured by the rebels. There's also a rumor that one of his own men shot and killed him in the chest. So it's, it sounds like it was very, very brutal and end. And, you know, you just have to kind of wonder, too, you know, all this war stuff kind of going on in the country of Libya, and the country in some places just being torn to pieces. How's this good for anyone? And you know, but anyways, I just wanted to share that since it does appear at this point that the NATO or French airstrikes may have played a role in his death.
Yeah, that actually does confirm some earlier reports, so thanks for sharing that with us. Getting back to the topic we were talking about, Gene, maybe I'll go to you because you probably were thinking about it a little bit, but doesn't it seem strange to you that despite the fact that they continue to claim that the inflation rate is low, only 3.9%, the fact that the basics have just taken off in price over the past year, and yet they treat that as if it's like a little secondary piece of information. At some point, you got to think that the government's going to notice that, hey, there's a serious inflation problem going on with the basics that we all have to live with on a week-to-week basis.
Well, yeah, and I think isn't it the core inflation rate? They actually take out food and energy prices?
Yeah, they do.
I mean, that's absurd.
That's,
I mean, what do poor people buy? Food and energy, you know?
Well, they go out and buy iPads. Didn't you know that?
Yeah. But, yeah, and then you throw in the fact of what they measure and how they measure it, and that it could be at least double, if not more. And, you know, I think just from our experience going to the grocery store and
you know, it's probably approaching 8-9%. I mean, depending on how you measure it, and you know, but it's something they want to hide. They want to make sure that we think it's in control, or else we might think that they're not in control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. We've got only a few minutes left, but I want to touch on one other article that I know you had on hand, Gene, the Pentagon War Machine. You have a very cute headline that you passed along. I'm just going to let you describe it.
Well, yeah, this is interesting because, you know, with all this talk with the budget and how the deficit is so massive, you know, the Pentagon and the defense and Homeland Security just seem to be escaping, and it seems like they're going to continue to escape any cuts. And it's interesting, and I'll just make it real quick, but the Republicans seem to be standing, you know, all the candidates on this, like, we just got to be tougher, and Mitt Romney wants to spend $30 billion more a year. And they keep pointing to Obama being weak, and yet Obama has...
Well, all but one anyway. Ron Paul's not standing that way.
Yeah, exactly. Ron Paul isn't. But Obama has been, you know, I think he's been ratcheting up defense, you know, tens of billions of dollars a year since he took office. So it's really... And then, of course, the Defense Department itself is claiming it can't have any cuts there, and you kind of wonder where it's going to end. I mean, you know, there has to be some sensibility here, I think.
You would think so. You would think so. And yet, I loved your headline that you passed along. The headline, folks, was Pentagon War Machine Parties On Despite Budget Problem.
It's exactly what they're doing, you know.
That was just great.
Well, hopefully that'll change.
Partying. I do recall, though, that I saw, I can't remember exactly where it was, but it was a piece that was lauding, in fact, maybe I got to hear it, it was lauding the Ron Paul proposals. I don't know if people knew about it, but this past week, Ron Paul proposed $1 trillion in budget cuts if he's elected president. And he actually detailed something a candidate normally never does. He actually detailed where he was going to do the cutting. Of course, the major media basically ignored this massive proposal that he made, and what little exposure he's gotten has been mostly negative. But nevertheless, there have been a few slight bright spots along the way, one of which, here it is, it came from Investor's Business Daily. Andrew Malcolm wrote an editorial which he said, he had to start, of course, with a little slight at Ron Paul. He says, the isolationism of Ron Paul hurts his chances to be seriously considered for the presidency, but on cutting domestic spending, he outshines his rivals. No wonder the media won't take him seriously. That's one of the most bizarre paragraphs I've ever seen, especially
yeah,
for an opening paragraph.
Any sense?
It doesn't make any sense. And what's even worse is he uses an old canard that isn't even true. Ron Paul has long been accused of being an isolationist. And in fact, he's not an isolationist.
No.
If you follow their logic, what they're basically saying is anyone who is opposed to the idea of having their country have soldiers in all the countries around the world, then they're isolationists, which means most of the world is isolationist because most of the world doesn't have their armies in the countries of the world.
Well, yeah.
So the U.S. is the only non-isolationist nation? I mean, come on. It's the craziest
thing. And yet we were founded on isolationism.
Oh, good grief.
So do you remember what was his defense budget, did he say?
I don't remember exactly how much he cut off defense. Unfortunately, I didn't prepare that portion of it because I didn't think we were going to get to it this week. I'll do some more in-depth research for next week's show.
It was at least 15%.
Is that what it was? It was 15%?
Yes.
Yes.
I believe so.
Yeah. Oh, there it is. You're right, 15%. And that of course, is a significant cut because anything that you cut from a Republican point of view is, oh, my God, you can't cut that. You got to cut the safety net, but you can't cut the national defense. Oh, my God.
Well, even Obama's cuts are actually cuts in inflated spending. So,
yeah.
In other words, it's supposed to go up, but we're instead of going up 20%, we're only going to go up 15%. That's his cuts, you know, whereas the Republicans, oh, you can't cut it at all, you know.
Well, I certainly can't cut it if what we have to do is try to cut increases because I have trouble increasing my income by any amount.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess I live in a different world from Washington, D.C. Well, unfortunately, we're at the end of the hour here, and we're going to have to pick this up next week. But Jake and Gene, as usual, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it was fun. Thanks, you guys.
And we'll see you all next week here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.
Take care, everyone.